From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange. The shootings in Arizona have focused attention on the rhetoric of our politics. Has it gotten so heated that it sparked the violence in Arizona? New polls show most Americans reject that argument, but it hasn't stopped federal lawmakers from proposing legislation to turn down the heat. Also, will the shooting spark a new push for federal gun control legislation? You can join our conversation about these and other related questions concerning politics and rhetoric with our guest analysts this week, Bruce Gronbeck from the University of Iowa and Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State University. Our discussion starts right after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange, a chance for us to analyze and think out loud about recent political developments in the nation and right here in Iowa. This week, we obviously want to get your reaction to the shootings in Arizona. Does this tragedy mark a watershed moment when we look at the heat of the political rhetoric and decide as a nation, let's turn down the temperature, let's be more civil? Will the shootings spark a new push for federal gun control legislation? A couple of the questions we're going to address when we reach that topic a little bit later in the hour. Joining us to discuss this and other political matters during the hour, Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Stefan, welcome back. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be on again.
And Bruce Gronbeck is with us, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Bruce, thank you for joining us.
I'm glad, too, to be here, especially with Stefan.
Okay, here we go. We want to ask our listeners again to tell us what's on your political mind as we address a couple things before we get to the tragedy in Arizona and the political fallout of that. What parting words do you have for Governor Culver? We heard his condition of the state address yesterday. Words of praise for a job well done in some of the worst economic times Iowa has seen in a long time? Or do you say good riddance, onward to a new era under Terry Branstad? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at Iowa Public Radio. .org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Before we get to a little remark about Culver, let's address something that happened today. The new Chief Justice for the Iowa Supreme Court gave his condition of the judiciary speech this morning in the Iowa House. He used some of his time at the Capitol to ask for an increased budget for Iowa courts, but he also took some time for a civics lesson. Justice Caddy talked about several misconceptions about Iowa's courts, defending Iowa's merit system for selecting judges and justices, talking about judicial review, calling for more openness in the courts, and in conclusion, he talked about the rhetoric that's been used in the campaign to unseat three Iowa justices after a ruling that cleared the way for same-sex marriage in Iowa.
Let us go forward to continue to write our history through the stories of the people of Iowa in a way that our children and their children will look back on with pride. The same pride that we can look back on today at the work of those who have preceded us. Let us go forward with the courage found in the past and the courage of the convictions of our Constitution. Let us go forward with greater openness, not only in the way that we all do our work, but in what we know and what we understand today about each other and the world around us. And let us, too, go forward with a new understanding that rhetoric does have meaning and with an understanding that rhetoric must be responsible.
Iowa's new Chief Justice Caddy there. Is this speech likely to have any impact on the campaign to impeach Iowa's remaining justices their role in this Varnum decision? Stefan Schmidt, your thoughts there?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think what has happened in Iowa with the judicial system is that the fire has jumped over the threshold or the fire breach, and there is now a completely political discussion on the part of some people about appointing and keeping justices not only in the Iowa Supreme Court, but there has even been discussion this week about launching a campaign to unseat justices and judges all the way up and down the judiciary unless they meet certain litmus tests that you get them to basically answer a questionnaire. And if they answer wrong, then you launch a campaign against them in the retention election. And I think that is a different environment from what we have had before. And when you have a system where judges are appointed and then come up essentially for reappointment by voters, the system works until it becomes highly politicized. And I think that's where we are at now.
Mm-hmm. And you don't see anything holding us back from more politics in our judiciary?
I don't at all, because the last effort to basically remove justices based on a single ruling was very successful, and everyone was amazed. And I think there's nothing like the taste of blood or success to make you simply want to continue down that road. And there are some very conservative groups and leaders in Iowa, and a lot of Iowans are quite conservative. And so I think this is going to now be tested in the next round. And it's already being tested in the sense that conservatives are pushing Governor Branstad to basically impeach the justices that are left. Branstad has said he's not going to touch that one. And an effort to basically change the judicial appointments board, which is has a large number of members appointed by the law community, and put more, quote, ordinary citizens on that board. That's going to be is already an interesting political struggle. So we're seeing a highly political debate going on in an area that normally was left a little bit more to, quote, the experts, which would be the legal community.
In light of Chief Justice Katie's words this morning on the condition of the judiciary, do you have anything to add to that, Bruce Gronbeck, in observing
that?
Yeah,
a couple things. One, I think I've only I haven't heard the whole thing, so, and I hope I can pick that up. But one, he talked obviously, in good judge that he is, in very general terms about such things as the Constitution and judicial review, his civics lesson kinds of parts, which is a good circumspect but very indirect and abstract way of talking about the issues, until it seems to me counter arguments are offered that have more specificity and more bite to them. I think Stephan's absolutely right that the resistive conservative side is I don't mean conservative in a kind of a normal ideological way, to recall the judges and finally make even our judicial system a matter of popular will, a scary thought is going to have the momentum. And I think this is pretty deep. I agree with Stephan there too. I'm a precinct officer over on election night in Marengo for a rural township, a place with no towns at all. And as we check out the ballots at the end of the day of voting, I noticed not only were the Supreme Court justices was there voters in favor of recalling them, but voters also were in favor of recalling the district judges and even the juvenile judge, for goodness sakes. That is, it ran right through the whole judiciary. Once folks got to the backside of the ballot and started checking no, their pencil moved right down the ballot. So this I think is a general attack on the judiciary system as a whole, at least as it was occurring in the townships of Pilot, Troy, and York in Iowa County, and so it's a serious issue.
Professor Bruce Gronbeck with us. Communication Studies of the University of Iowa. Stephan Schmidt with us, political science professor at Iowa State University. Chewing over a few items of politics. Of course, we want to get to the Arizona shootings, the political fallout there in terms of political rhetoric in just a few minutes. But before that, Governor Culver said goodbye yesterday in his condition of the state address. Incidentally, the governor has accepted our invitation to be on this program live tomorrow at this time. We'll have a conversation with Governor Culver. In his final condition of the state speech of his term yesterday, he outlined his administration's accomplishments, and this was the line that drew the most applause.
We tackled racial disparity in sentencing and youth detention. We appointed a record number of women and minorities to boards and commissions. We passed the first in the nation minority impact law, and we stood tall to protect the constitutional rights for all Iowans, regardless of race, gender, or sexual orientation.
Regardless of race, gender, or sexual orientation, in the interest of time, we faded out the applause, an applause that went on after that line for over a full minute. Now, is this likely to be the governor's legacy, even though he really had no role in the Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage? Bruce Gronbeck.
No, it won't be. You're right. He had no role, and as a matter of fact, he was on the other side of the issue, even though once it was passed, he certainly agreed to enforce it and carry it forward. I think the rest of his speech, where he's putting a good positive spin on all that was accomplished during his governorship, the beginning of the turnaround of the economy, a series of other economic initiatives, the kinds of things that he finally, in the last month of the campaign, was trying to campaign on, I think will be seen much more as his legacy. This line certainly will come up again and again, given where we're going to be going with especially that last part, the matter of sexual orientation, as it comes back in the judicial debate. But I think he did a pretty good job in the rest of the speech saying here's how far we got in one term. And I think especially was his comments on the state of the economy generally, trying to hold the flow of the tide to further reduction of state budgets and so on, is much more indicative, I think, of where the center of his legacy probably will be, or he hopes
Stephen,
it'll be.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, what is your view on how this governor will be remembered? What will he be remembered most for?
He won't be remembered very much, because if you ask most Iowans at the mall about governors, you know, a few decades back, they don't have a clue who they were, what they did. His legacy is going to be in history books for others. And in a few years, no one will actually really remember who he was or what was going on. In the short term, he will be remembered as a governor who managed not to put forth the sort of successes and the efforts that he was making to bring recovery from floods, to stem the tide on a collapsing economy, and try to create jobs both with Iowa resources and with federal stimulus money, and did so fairly skillfully, but managed to be defeated because his administration was racked by all kinds of scandals and problems in administrative agencies that overshadowed the successful leadership that he offered. And I think it'll be, if nothing else, a record. And a record, don't forget, the reason he lost the election and lost it fairly decisively, of often awkward leadership, I would call it. I don't want to be any meaner or more critical than that, but having somewhat of a tin ear, not showing up for disasters the minute they occurred and offering leadership there, having a little bit of a reputation of a short temper that turns some people off, and I think it'll be a mixed record at best.
Stephen Schmidt with us, along with Bruce Gronbeck. It's Politics Wednesday here on The Exchange, and a few days have passed since the weekend shooting rampage in Tucson, all over the media, of course. We want to move now to discuss a few aspects of American politics, political rhetoric that this has raised. The shootings this weekend at the town hall-style meeting of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords has sparked a lot of discussion about issues, one of which is the tone of our politics in this country. It was an issue raised by Pima County, Arizona Sheriff Clarence Dupnik. Here's what he had to say at a media briefing just after the shootings.
When you look at unbalanced people, how they are, how they respond to the vitriol that comes out of certain mouths about tearing down the government, the anger, the hatred, the bigotry that goes on in this country is getting to be outrageous. And unfortunately, Arizona, I think, has become sort of the capital. We have become the mecca for prejudice and bigotry.
Exchange listeners, what do you think? Tell us what's on your mind when you mull over the things you've heard about this shooting, the political inferences that we've heard. We have no idea at this point what caused the shooter to go on a rampage. Nevertheless, do you hope this Arizona tragedy will change the harsh tone of politics in our country? What are your thoughts? 1-866-780-9100 as we discuss political rhetoric with this as a backdrop. 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. And do you hope or fear it will spur tighter federal gun regulation? And remind us again, Stefan, may I go to you, about the heated races in this past midterm election in Arizona, to give us a backdrop there.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of brutal language in races. I don't have in front of me exactly which races they were, but certainly the congresswoman herself was in a fierce race. And Arizona is, in fact, the Wild West of the United States. And this is well known. It's not a secret. The Arizona legislature has been in waves, making it easier to carry firearms and carry them in many different locations. And therefore, you know, that entered into the race in Arizona. But more generally in the United States, there was a lot of, let's just call it, if nothing more than impolite and often fairly brutal language used in races where candidates actually had featured firearms in their commercials, shooting at cap and trade. Sarah Palin put clearly a target, a gun target, a rifle target over Democrats running for Congress that were targeted for defeat. And Congresswoman Gillibrand was one of them. And so there was, I think, a higher level of brutality in the elections. It was one of the nastiest elections in my memory in 40 years of studying politics. And that by elections, I mean all of across the country. There were people who, one radio talk show woman in Florida who was supporting one of the candidates, Republican candidates for Congress, and subsequently he said he didn't want her to be a staff person, actually does her radio show with, I think it's a 38 special, sitting right on next to her microphone, and talks about it frequently, you know, a chick with a gun and so on. So, you know, that's where we are in the United States in terms of the political rhetoric, people shouting, "You lie," when President Obama gives his State of the Union address, people shouting, you know, he's not a citizen or a naturally born citizen. Just recently, when the members of Congress were reading through the Constitution and got to the part that defines what the requirements are for running for president, those are things that don't happen very often, and we saw that all over the country. And I think it made it legitimate for people to attack individuals and to attack the government as a whole, which was often painted as being an evil thing and the enemy of the American people. And I think that sets the tone for a discussion of the country, of issues in the country. It doesn't necessarily give instructions to people to go out and kill people the way the radio show in Rwanda, Radio Mille Collines, did during the Rwandan massacre, where they actually gave instructions from the radio station and told people where to go to massacre people in churches and markets and so on. We're not there yet.
A majority of Americans reject the view that heated political rhetoric was a factor in weekend shootings in Arizona. This is according to a CBS nationwide telephone poll conducted Tuesday. Various politicians and commentators, as we've just mentioned, have said the climate in which strong language and ideological polarization is common may have contributed to the attack. 57% of respondents said the harsh political tone had nothing to do with the shooting, compared with 32% who felt it did. Interesting how this breaks down. According to party lines, the rejection of the link was strongest among Republicans. 69% felt the harsh rhetoric was not related to the attack. 19% thought it played a part. Democrats, 49% placed no blame on the heated political tone. 42% did. Bruce Gronbeck, what are your observations about this whole debate that's raised over the tone of political debate?
Well, I think, one, for me, the basic thing is that the country seems to go through periods of this kind of so-called toxic rhetoric, including, periodically. Since my political upbringing is in the 50s and 60s, we run from the Cold War talk to the anti-war talk that becomes anti-war actions and social movements that becomes violence against buildings that becomes violence against people. I think in our own time The interesting metaphor that we use now to talk about our media environment is one of disease. Videos go viral, and we think about them as a virus that spreads beyond our control quickly. Just as 50 years ago, Crane Britton talked about revolutions in America or France or Russia as fevers that strike a people. I think those begin to indicate that we understand something has happened not just to the mad men and mad women who shoot at presidents and other kinds of people, but that something happens to ourselves as a citizenry where issues seem to begin to spin out of ways where we can't control them, and yet the citizenry in fact does participate. They do change who they vote for. They do go to rallies. They do cheer and holler. They do send in money. There's something – I guess where I am is that no, Sarah Palin's website didn't cause any shooting, but it did contribute to that general environment. And it's certainly not only coming from the right. It's coming from the left. It's coming from the middle. It's coming from Tea Partiers. It's coming from all kinds of people. And it creates an atmosphere, not that causes that violence, but that becomes justifications or almost permissions to do things in extreme ways because the times, they are changing and they're getting worse. And then we cool down and we look at the better sides of ourselves and our motives. We go find our angels and see what we can do to make things a little better.
We have to take a short break.
Okay.
We'll be right back. Bruce Gronbeck with us. Stefan Schmidt with us. Just getting started. We are Bruce Gronbeck with us. Stefan Schmidt with us. We want to hear what is starting you in this debate. What do you make of the way some politicians and commentators are speaking of the Arizona tragedy, playing the blame game? Is it deserved? Does this get us anywhere? We want your opinion. Also about gun regulations. We'll talk about this in the second half hour. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Back in just a few minutes. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Next time on The Exchange, tomorrow at this time, a live conversation with outgoing Governor Chet Culver. We'll follow up on his condition of the state address earlier this week. Get his take on his accomplishments over the last 4 years tomorrow in the 12 o'clock hour of The Exchange. Also a conversation with two incoming department leaders in Iowa, Chuck Palmer taking control of the Department of Human Services, Debbie Durham of the Department of Economic Development on our program tomorrow live over the noon hour. Then on Friday, ties in with our discussion today, an entire hour in which we'll look at Iowa's new Shall Carry weapons law. Perhaps you're not aware of it. We have new weapons laws here in Iowa since the beginning of the year. Hear about that Friday on The Exchange over the noon hour. Today, it's Politics Wednesday. So glad to have with us Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, Bruce Gronbeck, professor emeritus of communication studies at the University of Iowa, and you are a big part of Politics Wednesday as we analyze, think out loud about recent political developments in the nation and here in Iowa. And we want to devote the rest of the hour to your thoughts, your reactions to the shootings in Arizona, also the political fallout of this tragedy. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Now, as it happens, this tragedy comes as Iowa's new shall carry law is implemented. The law approved last session, now in effect, makes it more difficult for county sheriffs in Iowa to deny permits to carry concealed weapons. It also strengthens training requirements. Iowa Public Radio has been reporting on GOP legislators in the state who say there's no reason to believe this tragedy will stand in the way of loosening gun restrictions further, while some Democrats, for instance, Senator Bob Dvorsky of Coralville, says we may want to tighten restrictions in light of what has happened in Arizona and previous times in the United States. We want your input. 1-866-780-9100. So let's tackle this right now, the gun control debate. What will likely happen because of this tragedy in Arizona? Stefan Schmidt.
The New Hampshire legislature, as their first act, the new Republican supermajority there, made it easier for people to bring firearms to the State House and carry them, including people in the gallery in the State House. My former student and right-hand person to Arizona Governor Napolitano, who is now the head of Homeland Security, sent me a couple of emails this morning. One of them is about the amazing increase in gun sales, especially the 33-round magazine Glock, right in the aftermath of this shooting. And State Representative Al Balsadero of New Hampshire said the reason New Hampshire is the safest state in the country is because a lot of us carry firearms, and that's how you make things safe. And a new state senator, Lori Klein, in Arizona, brought a special guest to the Arizona State Capitol on Monday. The article in the Arizona Republic says, and it was her .38 special, which she carries in her purse. She says, "I pack. Our safety is our personal responsibility." So I guess that seems to be the early evidence of what the results are of the shooting, is that people are going out and buying additional firearms because this proves how dangerous this country is and that you'd better be able to protect yourself or be able to protect others. There's even a discussion in Arizona about allowing firearms, professors to carry firearms and allow students to carry firearms at colleges and universities. So I am not sure that this is going to lead to a discussion about increased gun regulation when the whole trend in the United States, including Iowa, which had an interesting firearms law. You had to go to the sheriff, and the sheriff really had to sort of decide whether you might be a risk or not. It was pretty tough to get a permit to carry a concealed weapon county by county, and Paul Fitzgerald of Story County was apparently the most diligent in scrutinizing people. Story County was one of the hardest counties to get a permit to carry a concealed weapon. That's all gone now. You can go in, you can buy the firearms, which is pretty easy to do anyway. All you do is go to the sheriff's office and they run a little short background check on you and give you a piece of paper, and you go down to the gun shop and start charging up on your MasterCard. And then you can go in now to the sheriff's office and get that permit to carry that concealed weapon and carry a weapon in a lot of different places. So I don't see any real sort of reversal of that particular trend, frankly.
Before we go to callers, let's talk to Bruce Gronbeck, your view on the effect this will have on gun control legislation, if it will be ramped up tighter or looser.
It's nice to know that Stefan and I can now move down to Arizona and protect ourselves in our classrooms. The attempt to control place is one of the ways that we're trying to approach this problem, and that's Bob Dvorsky's bill that he wants to put forward to say you shouldn't be carrying, as I understand it, be able to carry firearms into city council or school board meetings.
Right.
I don't know that controlling place is going to solve the problem. The move on the federal level, as I was hearing about it earlier this week, was to control not guns. That the anti-gun people have just about given up on that, but to control ammunition, to say, okay, you know, do you really need a 30-shell clip to carry around in your Glock? If you're going to protect yourself in your bedroom and put 30 rounds into the walls and doors of your bedroom, you're going to destroy your house at the same time. Or if you're being attacked by a whole gang, that's not going to do you any good anyway. The move to control ammunition may be a way to make some progress, but until there are ways to temper the influence of the NRA in this country, and it's 4+ million voters who will send letters at a moment's notice, I don't think we're going to make an awful lot of progress.
And also, Bruce, can I add something?
Yeah.
Because I grew up in a country that had extremely rigid gun control laws in Colombia, South America. I was born there, grew up there. You were not allowed to own a gun, and the only place you could, you know, it was very difficult to get a permit, and the only place you could buy ammunition was from military bases.
Right.
The only place.
Hmm.
Everybody in Colombia had a gun, and you could buy ammunition from about four guys on each corner of the main plaza of Cali, Colombia, my hometown. And so, you know, laws and enforcement is also a function of the culture. And we have laws against illegal drugs, and yet you can buy them in any town in the United States 24/7 because the culture of the society is permissive on them. And I think there is in American culture something that says that gun ownership and the right to carry firearms and buy ammunition is kind of the American way. And if you pass tough gun laws, you can still buy guns. You know, that's why bad guys always have guns. They don't have a permit, and they didn't buy the ammunition in a legitimate place, but they have lots of firearms. And it seems to me that it is sort of a pervasive thing, and probably the safest place for you to be is to work at the cafeteria at an airport, you know, because that's one of the places where they don't let you carry guns and ammunition in, and we do have severe gun control the minute you walk into an airport and try to go through that security line, but we don't have much of that in other places.
In
countries
Bruce,
like Colombia, you have metal detectors, and they frisk you, and the pat-down that the TSA does, they do it in almost every major government office building because so many people carry firearms, and so you work in secure environments, but everybody is armed, and you know, that's a tragedy.
Well, in this country, we've just not been able to regulate the gun show sales.
Sure.
Then you're messing with free enterprise, and it's so that the escapes around regulation are multiple. The question is still, I think, for bleeding hearts like me, is, you know, what kind of environment are you creating when you do adopt the amazingly permissive laws
on firearms? Stefan, we have to get to callers. We asked for our callers, and they are waiting in droves to react to what we're talking about. Let's first go to Caleb in Chiron. Caleb, welcome to our program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my
call. Hi, go ahead. You've been listening to our discussion. What's on your mind there from Western Iowa?
Well, I just wanted to bring up the fact, hopefully the rest of the world doesn't take offense to this, but the stupidity of the American people. I'm going to bring up an example. Like the turn of the century for 2000, people were going absolutely berserk. When, like, computers are going to crash, people were rioting, and oh my God, the world's going to end, this, I believe, will have the same effect.
The new gun, are you talking about the new gun law or the tragedy in Arizona? No effect from either one.
I'm talking about the effect of this new gun law, and I believe that the tragedy in Tucson had something to do with it. But, you know, there's always stupid people out there, you know. You can carry your guns into a bar now. It's not against the law. People are drinking, they're having a good time, getting pretty inebriated. Well, somebody makes them mad, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to pull their weapon.
Right.
Or they want to pull it to their buddies, and they have a negligent discharge, and somebody gets shot and killed or wounded. You know, there's going to be, you know, people are going to act really stupid with this new law. But
you're saying whatever we do, whatever legislation we have, people are going to act stupid, and we're going to have incidents like this. So no big change for you, right, Caleb?
There's always going to be that one person in the crowd.
Okay, thank you, Caleb. Let's move on to our next caller. Sam is in West Branch. Hope you're still there, Sam. Hi.
Yeah, I am.
Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Yeah, well, I can't add anything to, you know, what your panelists have said, but I, you know, we're talking about climate, whether it's this gun climate or the tragedy in Arizona, and I must confess, it doesn't surprise me that people didn't think this had any impact on this young man doing this. And I come from an era where I remember in the Iowa football stadium over a half a century ago, when the quarterback came up to the line of scrimmage, the crowd quieted down so he could call his plays. And now when I go there, and I do, I love football, I can't believe the cops come in and break up a fight down to my right. The T-shirt on the person coming, a lot of people coming in when we play Michigan says Ann Arbor is a blank, you know, and the whole nature of our culture is really in your face combative.
So it's just this is lack of civility, and there's a movement to restore
civility
in our political culture.
You know, we've become like the Roman Empire when they did a thumbs up or a thumbs down. The only thing is outside the Colosseum, you know, this in-your-face attitude. And I think your last guest on the phone was trying to say this is going to blow up. I can't picture that people who think they need to carry a gun because they're frightened, that they aren't going to use that gun. And I can't believe, you know, we're playing like the young man in Arizona, targeting people and the rhetoric like that. And we want
Second Amendment solutions.
Yeah,
yes.
We don't know. We want to pretend like that doesn't have any impact on people, and yet we're talking over the telephone trying to convince each other. And we're trying to pretend that that didn't have an impact. I want to tell you, that's playing with matches on a powder keg. And we've been doing that. And I think your last guest was trying to say, this is going to blow up. I mean,
okay,
you know, fine. We did have the Wild West. We want to bring it back?
Thank you for that perspective, Sam, joining us. Let's move to Sandy in Coralville. Sandy, hi.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm fine. What do you make of all this?
Well, the reason I had called was because I was most disturbed by the fact that the smoke had not even cleared. No one knew anything about this gentleman yet, and already people were jumping all over the right and pointing blame at Sarah Palin. And when obviously, if you look at other shootings, such shooting incidents, this is obviously a very mentally disturbed person. And thus far, nothing politically motivated has come out. And I do agree with that, the previous callers, that there has been a coarsening of our culture. And there is a lot more use of profanity, and things are much more provocative. People are not polite anymore. And it's been taking place over time. But the thing that really has disturbed me about this whole situation is that it has been used by, you know, our seemingly biased media to say point the blame at the Republican Party. And that, to me, just makes things worse because it demonstrates to me what I as a Republican have felt for the last several years is that my point of view is not respected. There's no respect for a different point of view. The Tea Party, people who are actively saying this is not what we agree with, it's a policy disagreement, are being painted and portrayed as crazy people.
Right. We've got it, Sandy, from both sides, trying to paint each other. So let's talk about that a little bit. Bruce Grunbeck, from the get-go, we had the right and the left going at this. And spinning it. Could there be a backlash for one or the other camps?
Well, I think they did. I went on Slate.com early, and they were the left was piling up and blaming the right. And then, of course, I go get clips of Rush Limbaugh, who is saying the left trying to make hay out of this when they're really to blame in the first place. But I think more interestingly, some of those other high-profile figures said, let's back up a little bit. I mean, even Glenn Beck, bless his heart, said, you know, we got madmen doing some shooting here, and there are terrorists. He'll give you that. And if there are madmen or crazy people or terrorists then that's where the problem lies, and we have to spend our time there. Or you know, John Stewart backed up and said, you know, we can't blame each other. We can't blame the left or the right. Crazy people are operating. We've got to find a way to make the country better after events like this.
And
more. Keith Olbermann even apologized for his what he called clumsy metaphors, and he promised not to use them again. I think the conversation over left and right is already being tempered a good deal, and it's not just that. It's a lot more.
I want to go to Stefan in a minute, but Bruce, to follow up, because you are a study of political rhetoric and communication especially. When we look back at the history of political rhetoric in this country, hasn't inflamed rhetoric always been a part of the landscape, or are we in some unusual times now?
No, it has. I mean, the first great presidential election, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, they called each other a bunch of serious names. That Adams is being called a drunkard and a radical, and Jefferson was being called a Francophile, a guy that loved France more than he liked his own country. These were being carried around on placards and posted by mounted horsemen for both of their parties. This has been attack rhetoric has been a part of our politics forever and ever. Not necessarily like where we are now, though, with death metaphors. I mean, we're playing a pretty serious game when we begin to move strongly, not simply into the usual kinds of attack on policy or even personal habits, but begin to get into questions of fear leading to violence and death. I don't think we're always there. And whenever this country, it seems to me, gets into that point, as has been pointed out by lots of others, we get into assassinations. We've had presidents assassinated and a lot of other politicians assassinated. And we've led into places where the country has gasped at what it's done to itself in that feverish state that I was talking about earlier. And then we back off. So, yes, attack's always there, but we're at a point of extremity where we're going to have to back off.
We've got just a couple minutes left. Stefan Schmidt, what do you see when you look forward as far as this rhetoric? Staying the same, heating up even more, or will we temper it somehow?
I think there will be criticism of things that go beyond sort of, you know, what might be considered real powerful and serious policy disagreements. But the other thing we haven't talked about is that we also have a despicably lousy mental health care system in this country. The guy that shot these people had a very, very long record and many, many multiple contacts with authorities. And it was all based on his threatening behavior. I talked to a friend of mine who's retired now, sent me an email and said, when I was a prosecutor in Iowa, people like this guy would have been committed. He said we would have put them in an institution because when people looked like they would pose an imminent danger and a threat to the community, we would be able to put them into a facility, get them into treatment, provide them with medication, supervise the administration of that. And if they then reached a point where we thought they would be safe to let them come back into the community, we would. He said when we deregulated and closed the institutions and said we don't want to institutionalize people anymore, he said a lot of problems began because you couldn't really do anything preemptive about people who clearly had patterns of behavior that, like the shooter at Virginia, Virginia Tech and other places, showed signs that were enormous alarms going off, and yet the relevant authorities and people surrounding the person really did nothing and could do nothing. I think we're going to have to revisit that as much as we are gun regulation and gun laws.
The hour is over. Thank you, Stephen Smith of Iowa State University, Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll look forward to having you again on the program.
Glad to be here.
Want to remind you all, tomorrow at this time, a live conversation with outgoing Governor Chet Culver. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese in Ames. Russell Mansky helped us out in Des Moines. Emily Boyer, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Jeff Schmidt. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.